Probably more important than what people say is say what recovery is about is what people do when they do recovery. So let's look at that. What do people do when they do recovery? If you were, you know, from another planet and you came here and you went on a Thursday night to a little church that had a recovery ministry, what would you observe people doing? The first thing you'd observe is people would probably be getting together in small groups. Now, that's an important behavior. The modern recovery movement owes a debt, certainly on the Christian side of things, owes a significant debt to the small group movement, which emerged in the American church from the early 40s, 50s, and 60s. I mean, there are still churches, of course, where forming small groups feels like a dangerous activity because you might be creating little cliques, or you might be, there's all kinds of reasons people resist getting together in small groups. And I suppose it's worth mentioning that there's nothing magical about making small groups. If you have a large group where the social dynamics are all terribly toxic, and you just take that toxicity and break it down into smaller groups, you're just going to have smaller toxic groups. So there's nothing magical about small. On the other hand, it is potentially a very important thing. People will say things in small groups that they won't say in large groups. People will have an opportunity to say things in small group that they would never have an opportunity to say in small groups, in large groups. Large groups, you're going to have someone speaking. Or you're going to wind up probably with people in rows watching people talk and sing. That's sort of the normative large group in the Christian context. And so small groups plays an important role in the recovery. Now, what you actually do in small groups turns out to be really important, and we'll talk about that anon. You'd also, if you watched more than just Thursday night, you'd see people getting together with mentors or sponsors or therapists or pastors or friends to talk about the stuff that they're later going to talk about in the small group. So you see, you know, people in different kinds of relationships talking about the stuff, and that's an important behavior. In both of these, you have social settings where people are talking about the stuff that's my problem. Okay, so there's social settings. I think that's really important, again, that the dominant dynamics of the recovery process are stuff that can happen in social settings, not in isolation. You wouldn't necessarily see people going off to be by themselves. There's nothing wrong with a silent retreat for a week, but it's not the kind of thing you typically see in a recovery ministry, because I already know how to be silent. I mean, for me to do a silent retreat, it's like, this is a piece of cake. It's not hard or threatening to be silent. I've been learning how to be silent since I was 2. So silent retreat is not challenging growth opportunity for me. Saying stuff about stuff that's real, about stuff that's my problem, is much harder, much more challenging. But let's talk about what behaviors you actually observe people doing in the small group meetings and in meetings with other people. One thing you'd observe very quickly is people doing inventory. This is what it's called in a 12-step context. You might use different words for it in other contexts, but this is a disciplined process by which people decide what's the stuff that's my stuff. In a 12-step context, you might start off, in fact, if you do it the way the big book does it, you would start off making a list of resentments, for example. Now, resentments are about other people. But you'd make a list of resentments, and then about each of those resentments, you might ask, well, what's my part here? I mean, there's other people's got parts. It's not that the whole thing is my problem, but you'd be asking, what's my part? What did I do at the time or before or after this that's the problem that's my problem that I can work on? Start taking a searching and fearless moral inventory is the way the big book talks about it. Searching, that is not just casual, Fearless doesn't mean without fear, it means courageous. So a searching and courageous moral inventory. Where have I done harm to other people or to myself? That's not a kind of thing you typically see. I remember the first time that I went to a 12-step group, one of the things that struck me was something about inventory. People were talking about that. And I've never really had a sensibility that that's the kind of thing that you would do. If you'd go to it'd be a very rare Sunday school class, for example, where people were doing inventory of their lives. A very rare worship service where that was part of what people did. You really have to go to recovery group to see people doing that. Now, it's a pretty traditional Christian discipline that's sort of asking God to come and bring light of Christ, to show with clarity what's really going on here inside of me. There's a lot of tradition behind that. And it's something that you don't typically see in Christian circles. Maybe some spiritual retreat settings you might sit, but it's kind of a normative part of the recovery process. Second thing, confession. This one was another thing that struck me as sort of shocking when I first started attending 12-step meetings, is that people would go around, well, actually in 12-step meetings, at least here in the States, what people will do is they'll start off by going around and they'll say, "Hi, my name's Dale and I'm a fill in the blank. I'm an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict, I'm a codependent, I'm something." Okay, that's the spiritual discipline of confession. That's telling the truth. That's, you know, saying what's real about me, what I need to confess. This is the problem that's my problem that I'm here to work on. That's a form of the spiritual discipline of confession. And what struck me like a ton of bricks is I'd just never seen that done. I've been in the Christian community all my life. I'd never seen that done. Now, I think the reason for that is confession in the circles I was raised in was something those people did. Okay? Catholics did confession. So we wouldn't want to do that because Catholics do that. We're good Protestants. We'll have, once a year, we'll have a service of confession and do a kind of perfunctory global confession for all the sins I ever committed. Don't really know what they are. Haven't paid much attention to them. Not working on them. But we'll sort of have this globalized confession. And as quickly as possible, have the pastor stand up to remind us that it's all better, it's okay, because of what Jesus did. But to see people actually doing confession, in the Christian community you have, this is a caricature, and there's a wonderful exceptions to it, but you have these two basic options. You have Catholics, again, wonderful exceptions, doing the spiritual discipline of confession in ways to optimize shame. Talk to anybody who went to Catholic school. You know, they've found over the years ways to, you know, pack as much shame as you possibly can into that spiritual discipline. And you have Protestants who solve this problem by not doing it at all. This is our way of solving this problem. Neither of these are particularly healthy options. The New Testament presents confession as a non-negotiable part of the normal Christian life. It's something that everybody does. We do it so we stay healthy. There's a connection with healthiness. You know, you can find these texts. It's not hard to find. Confession is just something that the expectation is Christians are going to be about doing that. I had never seen it done in a way that gave anybody any practical traction in life until I went to a 12-step group. That was the first place I said, you know, these people are doing confession and they don't seem to be leaving with more shame, they seem to be leaving with less shame. What is that about? Why do I have to learn about this from a bunch of late-stage street drunks? I've been in church all my life. Well, it's because we have simply abandoned the practice of confession as a practical discipline for helping us change. We don't do this. we'll do, sometimes we'll do feel bad, but feel bad is not the same as a spiritual discipline of confession. Confession is a social discipline. You have to confess in the presence of. It's a verbal discipline. You have to. It's a behavior, not a feeling. So the spiritual discipline of confession has a long, rather textured history, and it's used to great effect in recovery. If you're coming from another planet and you observe people doing that, you'd say, oh, I read about that in the Encyclopedia of Religious Behaviors of Humans. They say they do confession. I didn't see it when I went to church. I didn't see it when I went to Sunday school, but here it is. These people still do that thing, and they apparently find it to be helpful. So that's one of the things people do when they do recovery. They tell the truth about some of the stuff that's most difficult to tell the truth about. Another thing, we've already talked about this. You would see people going around. After they went around the circle and said, hi, my name is Dale and I'm what? They'd each take a time and they would tell a story. They'd have a narrative. While in practice there's a wide range of stuff that you actually see, hopefully what you'd see is people talking about what's going on right now. This wouldn't be about what happened to me 25 years ago when I had a peak religious experience. This is what I'm working with right now. This is how I see God active or not active in my life. This is what I'm struggling with related to the stuff I just confessed. And then you'd move on and someone else would talk. So it's about sharing a spiritual narrative and crafting a spiritual narrative. Each time you go back, you're crafting a new spiritual narrative. This is what's going on. Again, just the sort of bare, stark truth of this, I had never seen this before. Been in church all my life, and I just hadn't seen this done. The closest would be once a year, we would have testimony Sunday, and I remember the fear and trembling in the staff meetings prior to Testimony Sunday, worrying that we were not going to be able to keep, you know, the lady who we knew would want to get up and tell the same story she did every year and dominate the time. How are we going to prevent that from happening this year? How are we going to control Testimony Sunday so that it's uplifting and positive? And we want this, because we're only going to do it once a year, we don't want this to be a downer. It's got to carry all the freight in this one service. And so we would work really hard to sort of pick people ahead of time and coach them how to tell their stories. So it was inspiring. Okay? That's what testimony looks like when you take all its guts out. That's what it looks like when you Hallmark card it. You sanitize it. You leave out all the stuff that makes it human narratives. And just make it some sort of fictional narrative, not about my real life. Testimony, if you sort of save it for a once a year kind of thing, loses all of its potency for facilitating personal change. It just becomes perfunctory, and no one can do that well. It needs to be sort of deeply embedded in our lives, so we are always telling our stories. We are telling our stories in a different way. We're seeing new things all the time. We're trying stuff, and it didn't work, and that's the narrative. Two steps forward, one step back. One step forward, two steps back. All those narratives are important narratives for us to be telling each other, so we become the kind of people who are accustomed to hearing those stories, to telling the truth about our own stories. I mean, that sort of exchange is a very powerful spiritual discipline that also has a long history in the Christian community. Testimony was not invented in a hot tub in Big Sur in the 60s. This is a spiritual discipline that goes way back. Okay, this is not something that Christians should be experiencing as sort of new agey or strange. This has got a long history in the Christian tradition, sharing our stories with each other for the purpose of encouragement and spiritual growth and maturity. Making amends is another behavior that certainly in 12-step groups you would see people doing. I made reference to my name as Earl as kind of a caricature of that. Making amends is exactly, what it is an implementation of the traditional spiritual discipline of penance. Penance is something that Protestants don't do because why? Those other people do it. Okay? And so the options, again, available to us are to do penance in a way that maximizes the amount of shame that a person acquires, which is, with wonderful exceptions, quite common in the Catholic context, or the creative Protestant alternative, don't do it at all. Okay? Neither of these strike me as very creative and empowering options for us. The spiritual discipline of penance or making amends in the recovery context is this powerful engine for personal change. And when you watch those videos that I've signed, when you look at people doing the amends making steps, you'll hear a bunch of stories about people who did this and walked away not with shame, not feeling worse about themselves, but feeling personally transformed. You know, there is a picture of what the spiritual discipline of making amends or penance could look like. It doesn't have to be saying the rosary 50 times and feeling bad about yourself. It can be, something that really gives you traction for change in life. You'll see things differently. You'll feel things differently. You'll find new behaviors available to you because of the practice of that spiritual discipline. That's something I think the recovery movement could give the church as a whole. It's an offering. A blessing that the recovery movement could give the church as a whole if there was a willingness to receive. Prayer and meditation is another thing that you would observe people do. This is particularly true in distinctively Christian 12-step groups or other Christian recovery groups. You would see people encouraging prayer and meditation, and doing prayer and meditation. Now, let me talk about prayer mostly. Because, again, if you're a visitor from another planet observing prayer, you would see people praying in big church and praying in Sunday school, and you'd see people praying in recovery church, in recovery groups. And I think if you were observant observer, you would see something very different. You would see that the kind of prayer you're observing in a recovery group was really quite different than the prayer that you're observing elsewhere. Let me sort of caricature this to give it clarity, but let me tell you how I was taught to pray. I was taught to pray that what you were basically doing was making a list of the things I thought was important. And then I would take this agenda to God and ask God to be about the business of implementing the agenda that I had drafted. This did not strike me as odd, that I should be in charge of the agenda and God should be in charge of the implementation. This just seemed the way things were. That's how I was taught to pray. I make the list. God gets busy. Now, this is a bit of an overstatement, but not much. I think that was what, for me, the spiritual discipline of prayer was about. I decided what was important. I wrote down what was important. Sometimes I would, organize this list in order of importance so that God would be really clear about what his job was to do the most important things first. So I was bright enough and spiritual enough, spiritually discerning enough to know what was important. And God was the one that I trusted to really be about the business. Now that today to me seems like really, really screwy. Okay? Something's really, really wrong when Dale Ryan is in charge of the agenda and God's the one who just is about the business of putting it into practice. This is why you hear in 12-step tradition, for example, the saying, praying only for the knowledge of God's will and the power to carry it out. So God makes the list. praying for God, the knowledge of God's will, and we're about carrying that out. That's a completely different kind of spirituality, okay, where it's letting go of my capacity to be good enough, smart enough, spiritual enough to make the list of what's important. Letting go of that. Trusting God to be about the business of knowing what's important, and trusting God to communicate to me what's the most important things for me to be doing, and saving the bulk of my energy to carrying out, to implementation. It's a completely different instinct about prayer. I was kind of stunned by this at first, because I was so deeply committed to the notion that whatever list I came up with, I mean, there was a time in my life when I would have said, James needs to stop using marijuana. Okay? That would have been the top of my list, and I'd pray. What I was doing was asking God to be complicit in my codependency, is what it was, see? Because I was very codependently engaged in the process of controlling my son's drug use, and I wanted God to be just as codependent as I was. I wanted God to be, you know, reinforcing my codependency. So good to hear you praying that your son will stop using. I'll get on board and help you be as codependent as you need to be to make things better. Okay. My list was a reflection of my codependency, not of any kind of spiritual health. If I'd sat quietly and waited for God's list, at the top of God's list might have been, maybe you should get some help for yourself, rather than frenetically being about trying to fix somebody that you can't fix. And it wasn't until I was developed the capacity to sit and listen for God's list that anything good happened in my relationship with my son. Because I was over the top, frenetically codependent, trying to solve problems that were not my problems. When I got to the place where I could listen quietly to God's list, it tended to be really quite focused on the problems that were my problems. And those were the things that I could actually work on and expect something good to come out of. Yeah?
I guess you sort of define implicitly define codependency, but how would you define
that? Yeah, we'll spend probably half a session on that, because they're very different. I mean, it's a word that's gotten pretty diffuse. If you keep it in the context of substance abuse, it has a fairly well-defined meaning, but it's sort of gotten out of that box as the recovery movement, as the popular culture social movement has gotten out and about, and it can be a way of shaming people for just caring about other people, which I would, you know, there's nothing wrong with caring about other people. Here I want to focus on prayer as a spiritual discipline and what gives it power. I think that sort of acting out my needs for control in the context of prayer is not something that gave me any spiritual traction in life. It was really me trying to be God, me trying to play God, or at least do the kinds of things that God does, set agendas, decide what's important. And it was really important for me to let go of that. There's nothing wrong with exercise as sort of a self-clarification. This is what I think is important, being honest about what I'd like to see happen. But somewhere in the discipline of prayer, there needs to be a setting aside of all that, a shutting up, if you will, and a listening happens, where I say, you know, I've got all this stuff. I'm not well enough. I'm not healthy enough to really know how much of this needs to be on your table. And I'm just going to shut up and listen. And I'm praying for the knowledge of your will. Tell me what's on your list. And give me the power to carry that out. That's the kind of prayer that one would hope to find in a 12-step program. It's very different from what I'd learned. I was very anxious about it. Like I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing. But if you're just an observer of recovery, I think that's what you'd observe. It would sort of look familiar because it looked like prayer, but it might feel very different than the kind of prayer that you're accustomed to, because a very, very different instinct about the appropriate way to be about prayer. The sort of, you know, another thing that would be not uncommon in some Christian circles is a notion that if you pray hard enough, you can get God to change. And I think that kind of prayer would also be kind of very uncommon in a recovery context. That would be construed to be being more powerful than God. How's that working? Is that working well for you, trying to be more powerful than God? More godly than God? More smarter than God? You know, how is that working out really? It would be construed to be probably part of some sort of addictive process. It might be a religiously addictive process. It might be a codependency kind of process. But it is not until we come to the end of all that control freak stuff that you get into the kind of prayer that recovery ministry tends to focus on, which is a turning over, a surrender of the agenda for God's care, and a sort of waiting before God to know where we should focus our energies and efforts on changing me. Let's see if that's the last thing there. Service. This is something you'd see certainly in 12-step traditions. This is the 12th step of the 12. Reaching out to those who still suffer is an expression that you might hear. And it turns out to be a particularly important part of the recovery process. It's something I suppose you would see in Christian culture as a whole in different ways. People put an emphasis on this. There are, of course, dangers here. All of us want to turn our hurt into ministry as soon as possible. Okay? We want the stuff that has caused us to suffer to acquire some meaning by having our suffering be helpful to other people. And there is a danger that we will insist on that happening on our timetable. I mean, when I have been in the seasons of my life that were most full of suffering, I desperately want this to be useful to other people because it didn't seem like it was being of any use to me. I wanted it to be helpful to other people really quick so that I could have some sort of handle on why this suffering was taking place. Please, God, make this meaningful. And to a certain extent, that was one attempt to avoid the suffering that was at hand. I don't want to experience what I appear to be experiencing. I want to focus on something good coming out of this. That doesn't mean that the instinct towards service is a bad one. That's a very healthy, but that sort of using it as a way to avoid experiencing what I'm really experiencing is a trap that lots of people fall into. Okay, I think what I want to emphasize overall here is that for most people, recovery is about behavior. That we don't become a different kind of person by thinking about becoming a different kind of person. That we try new behaviors, spiritual disciplines are not about thinking about spiritual disciplines. Prayer is not about thinking about prayer or feeling about prayer. Prayer is about praying. I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer. You shouldn't need a whole half hour in class to talk about that, but I think it took me a good 15 years to figure that out, that it wasn't about understanding. It wasn't about getting it right in my head, that if you didn't do it, you haven't done it. And so talking about confession, understanding confession, is not the same as confessing. And certainly for those of us who are introverts, who prefer studying confession to doing confession, there's a challenging step there to getting to the behavior. Okay, questions overall about that behavioral emphasis? Yeah.
Small beginnings in recovery
Well, that's a great segue to what I want to talk about probably next time. But we'll talk about leadership dynamics in recovery ministries next time. Okay, so hold that, yeah.
Meditation.
Yeah. Meditation probably, 11th step in 12 step, in the 12 steps is sought through prayer and meditation to increase our conscious contact with God. So meditation is assumed to be a spiritual discipline that has a lot of value. There are certainly traditions in the Christian community that are very anxious about meditation. In spite of the fact that the biblical text is rich with encouragements to meditate, with examples of people who meditate, and in spite of the fact that it's a tradition in the Christian community with a long history. They're probably anxious, the people who are anxious about meditation are probably more anxious about sort of meditation without a focus. They've seen lots of New Age kinds of things that use meditation as a spiritual discipline, and they're wondering with whether meditation within a 12-step context could be like that. You'll find quite a range of practices of meditation within the 12-step context. I'm not saying that everything you're going to find there is going to feel like appropriate thing for Christians to be doing. But Christians, it seems to me, ought not to resist the notion of meditation. We ought to embrace this as something we've been saying all along. I mean, meditation is not, again, invented in a hot tub in Big Sur in the 60s. It just wasn't. Meditation has a 2,000-year history in the Christian context. It has a richness and a texture to it. Are there good ways to do it and bad ways to do it? Yeah. But as a general principle, if someone says, I'm finding meditation to be very helpful in improving my conscious contact with God, our first instinct ought to be, that sounds good. I mean, that's something that ought to work. That's something Christians have always sort of thought ought to be part of the package. So, is that responsive? You got something else?
Yes, but when you meditate, when a Christian meditates,
yeah.
Not necessarily in recovery, but it's on God's word, right?
Well, I think if you look through the history of the Christian discipline of meditation, you'll find a wide range of spiritual practices. You can have meditation on a text, which is a rich history of different ways of doing that. You can have meditation on characteristics of God. You can have meditation on one's own experience of God. You find within the Christian tradition just the richness here of different meditative practices. I think it'd be a mistake to think that the Christian tradition in this respect is a narrow one. There's a wide range of different spiritual practices here. And I think in the recovery context, you'll find people practicing meditation in a variety of ways. But this is, to me, it's an opportunity, since the recovery culture tends to be sometimes at a distance from Christian culture, one of the things that people in Christian culture can do is say, well, once you get to that prayer and meditation to increase your conscious contact with God, that's something we might be able to help you with. So we'll offer 11th step workshops to help you think through, we'll help you see some ways that Christians have done that. Maybe some of this stuff would be helpful to you. How you craft that, I think, is an important piece of tactics. But the notion that it's a point of contact that people on both sides of those cultures might be jointly interested in, I think, is a good one. I mean, we want to learn how to meditate better. You're learning how to meditate better to increase your conscious contact with God. Maybe there's some common ground there. I think that there is a lot of common ground there. Other questions? Yeah.
Are there any successful recovery groups out there that don't involve the spiritual process, that are strictly secular, and how they?
Yeah, there are. This is about recovery strategies that de-emphasize spirituality. There's lots of stuff like that out there. There are certainly people who, one extreme, think that addiction is fundamentally a disease that eventually will find the right chemicals to fix this. And the best we can do for you is to give you the best chemicals we have now, which can make detox easier and safer and less painful, and which can give you an aversion to consuming alcohol, for example. So we'll give you medication. That's a very strictly medical model kind of strategy. It's kind of an extremist view. I wouldn't say it's common out there, but that would be, if you went to one of those kind of programs, they wouldn't be doing a lot of talking about spirituality. It's possible now to go out and if you're detoxing from opiates, to go to a program that will render you unconscious for the detox period. So it's sort of a painless withdrawal from opiate addiction. I always thought it'd be great if you could go, you know, unconscious to meetings and so on. It's not a very great recovery strategy, but it would solve the pain problem. There's also it's important to remember that the dominant criticism of movements like AA in our culture is that it's entirely too Christian. I mean, in Christian culture, the largest concern is that it's not Christian enough. But in culture as a whole, the dominant criticism of AA is this is just a thinly disguised evangelism strategy. You guys are just doing religion and stuff. I mean, look at this stuff, these behaviors. It's all Christian behavior. So you're just doing Christian stuff and not being honest about it. Okay, and in reaction to that, there has been the emergence of a variety of recovery strategies that don't do the 12 steps because it's too Christian. May do some of these spiritual disciplines and say, well, it's not really Christian. It's just stuff that helps us. But there's SOS. What does SOS stand for? Do you remember? Secularists. I can't figure out what. If you're interested, I can give you some links of people who have tried to sanitize all the spirituality out of recovery. And there are certain kinds of sobriety that I think can be sustained without the intervention of spirituality. On the other hand, spirituality is a pretty persistent part of the human experience. I have yet to meet an atheist who couldn't describe in some detail the God who he believed did not exist. Okay, so spirituality is a pretty persistent part of a human experience. A theologian I used to respect a lot put it this way: you've got to serve somebody. And I think that is true. We all have deeply embedded with us some sort of spiritual experience. So I think even in strategies that do their best to sanitize what they experience as some sort of orthodoxy, or explicit religious stuff, are doing a lot of spiritual things. And my own conviction is that God seems quite gracious about honoring people who practice spiritual disciplines, even if they say they're not spiritual disciplines. That is, if you see someone practicing the spiritual discipline of confession, my instincts are that God doesn't say, well, but you don't understand that it's a spiritual discipline. You just think it's something to help you. I think God will bless people who practice spiritual disciplines, even if they explicitly reject the spiritual content of that discipline. Now, that's, you don't have to buy that. That's the sort of where Dale Ryan has eventually settled on that issue. It may not make sense to you at all, which is fine. All right, our time is up.